This is A New Angle, a show about cool people doing awesome things in and around Montana. I'm your host, Justin Angle. This show is supported by First Security Bank, Blackfoot Communications, and the University of Montana College of Business. Hey folks, welcome back, and thanks for tuning in. Today is our September edition of Incentives and Instincts, a recurring series in which I speak with economist and friend Bryce Ward about some of the broader issues facing our society. Bryce, how are you today?
School's back in session. It's great.
I know, isn't it great?
You know, by the end of the summer, if you have kids, they've spent too much time together, and they really do need a break from each other.
Yeah, these are two dads that work from home primarily, so yeah. Yeah, I feel your sentiment there. And as you said, the kids are back to school. It's always hard to say goodbye to summer. And schools get a bad rap. Generally, they're at the center of our culture wars. But the returns to investment in public schools are tremendous. And at the individual level, most American parents are happy with their kids' school. Bryce, let's start there. Talk about public perception of our education system.
So yeah, there's a variety of polls that ask different questions, so you get slightly different answers depending on exactly how you phrase it. But we'll start with Gallup. They've asked it for a long time, and you know, for years. And there was a little dip with COVID, but for years, 75-80% of parents are satisfied with their kids' school. Education Next, they have a different survey. They ask you to grade it, like A, B, C, D, whatever it is. I think it's like 2/3 of parents give an A or a B to their kids' schools. Mm-hmm. A different survey was done, you know, a few months ago. It didn't ask about school, but asked about where your kid was, you know. And 90% of parents think their kid is excelling or roughly where they need to be. So at least certainly from the, you know, from the parent perspective,
sure,
our schools seem to be delivering.
I mean, we should just pause for a moment, and I'm not sure what the listener thinks, but when I saw those numbers, I thought, one, that's tremendously higher than you would expect if you were to watch cable news, right? If you were to watch cable news or consume most popular media, you would think that our schools are a disaster, that, you know, either the curriculum is corrupt or the teachers were incompetent, but really, it's a huge success.
These same surveys, not always these exact ones, but if this is part of the I'm fine, but everything sucks mentality
exactly.
that has pervaded. You know, we see this with respect to people's financial situation, right? Like, how are you doing financially? 75% of Americans in 2021 were like, I'm doing fine.
Yeah, but the economy sucks.
But the economy's terrible. Right. I've heard of this with CEOs as well. Right. You know, ask CEO, how's the economy? It's terrible. How's your firm? How's your industry? Oh, it's great. Yep. We're going to grow.
Right.
You know, so we have this disconnect, which I think, you know, is part of that larger,
yes,
you know, we just went through on social media. But like, yeah, most people think that the world that they're living in is fine. That's not to say that there aren't going to be issues or problems. I mean, you know, there's certainly things that, you know, you may want to improve or whatever it is. But if we take a step back and we just look at, well, what is the big picture here? You know, I think the reality is that while people think that everybody else's schools are terrible, the school that they actually know something about is fine.
The school they have experience with.
Right. Which probably we should probably weight that more than my rating of what schools overall, right? Which are based on whatever cable news segment or whatever the, you know, the internet feeds me and, you know, give me some outrage about whatever schools are doing. But, you know, I think most people, you know, and we have more objective measures.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Let's get into that.
High school graduation rates are as high as they've ever been. I, you know, again, we'll see what COVID does to this stuff, but kind of, you know, as we got into COVID, high school graduation rates were up. The share of kids that go to college kind of plateaued for a while, but, you know, still is roughly or at peaks. Mm-hmm. An interesting paper was done that actually looked at a whole bunch of measures of skills between kids that graduated in the 70s or the late 70s and the late 90s.
Okay. So comparing one age cohort.
Yeah. Cohort. You know, we're due to get the, I know we've got to wait a little while for them to grow up. But like, these surveys that are done, these longitudinal surveys, one was started in the late 70s, one was started in the late 90s. So they took and they said, look, let's measure, you know, there's like test scores in there, there's job skills, uh-huh, there's educational attainment, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and yeah, over the course of 20 years, from the labor economist perspective, they had more skills.
Sure.
Right.
And what are, let's break that down. What are the skills we're talking about?
Well, you know, so in that case, I mean, they're kind of just trying to predict labor market success. So they're looking at, you know, the ASVAB test, which is, you know, the military test, you know, essentially it's an IQ test type thing. They're looking at, you know, your actual educational attainment that you achieve.
What their, grade level, you know,
grade
you
level,
made it to?
You know, I can't remember what else is in there, but sure. Yeah, but you know, oh, work experience and, you know, things that you've done, you know, that kind of stuff. And so, you know, we're succeeding in test scores are up. All, you know, these things are all, you know, there are trade-offs in terms of our pursuit of some of this stuff.
Sure.
You know, some people complain that the graduation rate is at least artificially inflated because of high stakes measures and things like that. And people have looked at it and they said, well, maybe some to some degree, but there clearly is something here, right? We really did get better at getting kids to graduate from high school in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. From, again, from a big picture perspective,
yes.
There's nothing that says, again, we'll see what COVID does to this long term. But, you know, we were on a trajectory with respect to what we were achieving that was at least as good as anything that you and I were dealing with. I won't say how many years ago we went to high school.
Yeah, let's not reveal that information. It's too depressing.
Or our parents or, you know, our older siblings or whatever it is. So, you know, I think we have to, it's too easy to be negative with respect to schools because that's what we do. We're negative about everything, you know, and it's important to at least start a conversation by saying, you know what, our schools, they do a pretty good job and they're doing, you know, as good of a job in terms of at least a lot of the stuff that we care about as we've ever done.
Right, right. And I think it's important to remember how we're describing this. This is an aggregate across the country. There are certainly school districts, individual schools, individual classes within schools that are in crisis. We're not denying that, but just in general, the system as it's put together at the national level and operationalized locally is doing it as well as it ever has.
Yeah, at least in terms of the stuff that's easily measurable.
Yeah.
Graduating a kid from high school, that's something we clearly care about.
Mm-hmm.
Promoting a kid into post-secondary education. The test score measures that we have, you know, there's this thing called the National Assessment of Educational Progress. In the last 20 years, math scores for fourth and eighth sure. graders have improved. English scores for fourth and eighth graders have improved. You know, I mean, you know, maybe we want them to go up faster. Maybe they're still not where we want them to be. And you're absolutely right. There is enormous variation in all of these things
mm-hmm.
across schools. And, you know, we're not trying to say that every school and every classroom is operating at peak
right,
efficiently.
Right.
But it's important to kind of start conversations about education with that, keeping this in mind that our system is not like a garbage system.
Sure.
It's a system that works pretty well and is certainly managing to keep our society functioning at some level.
Right.
You know, so.
Right. And what do we know about mechanism over that period of improvement? What are the causes? I mean, are there improvements in curriculum, facilities, teacher quality?
How do schools work, right? I'm going to break it into three categories. So first, you know, there's just the stuff that we always think about with schools, right?
Mm-hmm.
Cognitive skills, right? You know, okay, we're going to teach you how to read.
Right, do math, basic science.
You know, all that kind of stuff, right? And, you know, and that was 20 years ago. That's No Child Left Behind. And No Child Left Behind is at least partially responsible for some of these things,
mm-hmm.
right? It redirected resources within the educational system towards improving these tangible measures.
Right.
Right. Right? And when you incentivize something, people respond to it. And, you know, that's also part of what's happened with high school graduation. We, you know, changed how we tracked it. We changed how we measure it. There were some penalties or whatever for not meeting certain things. So, you know, I do think you have to attribute some of these at least measurable things
yeah.
to the fact that we paid more attention to them, right? We paid more attention to test scores. We paid more attention to graduation rates. And when you pay attention to something, it's not surprising to me, and probably to the listener, that, yeah, people will respond to, on a margin in that area. Okay, so that's the first area that schools work. And that's a big part of what schools have invested in. Not without fits and starts, not without making mistakes, you
sure.
know, in terms of how we do teaching or various pedagogies. You know, we can go next door and, you know, there's a whole bunch of people over there.
College of Education is the door, is the building next door to the Gallagher Business Building where we're recording.
You know, and, you know, there's people there that are doing studies and trying to, you know, figure out, well, what's the best way to teach a kid how to do math or reading? And, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, all sorts of changes that have gone on there. We'll see if they're effective or not. But
yeah, there are people who are smart and hardworking or trying to get better at what they're doing.
In some magic world, there's a recipe, right? And for every kid, we would know the recipe.
Yeah.
Right?
That's the ideal.
Right. This is the ideal. We would just know. You would show up like, my kids were watching Jumanji, the new Jumanjis with The Rock. You know, and you can tap your chest and it tells you your strengths and weaknesses, right? You know, it would be great. Everybody would walk into school. They would tap their chest. Their teacher would be able to look at them and go, ah, okay, we have a recipe for you.
Sure.
Right? We're going to do this at this point. We're going to do this. And, you know, the problem that we have is we don't tap our chest and get to see all those strengths and weaknesses. We kind of have to figure them out on the fly. And teachers are working at scale. And there's all sorts of challenges with trying to figure out that exact recipe for each student. Now, what we do instead is we have broad recipes. And those broad recipes, you know, like I said, to the extent that those broad recipes are feeding into better high school graduation rates or better test scores or you know, more college completion, we have the highest share of people with college degrees that we ever have. And we will continue to see that share go up. Mm-hmm. Those broad recipes are working. Just to get back to, so there's the cognitive component to that. But then there's two other things that we've learned relatively recently. So first, with the test scores and value, you know, we started measuring all this stuff on tests. But then somebody said, you know, the big thing that was always, you know, on the side was, well, there's all this other stuff. You know, not just other subjects that are left out of the testing, but non-cognitive skills.
Yeah, other skills, social skills.
Social skills, emotional skills, you know, hard work, motivation, all that kind of stuff, which kind of kept lurking in various studies that would come out and be like, well, there's this magic and it didn't seem to matter for test scores, but then we followed these kids up and they're adults and they're somehow doing better.
Yeah.
Right. So it's clearly the cognitive tests that they were taking throughout school weren't capturing this thing that they had that was lurking in their toolkit that they then deployed as adults and it turned into more money and more success. Mm-hmm. And we started to learn how to measure that at the school level as well. And it turns out that, yes, just like there are some schools that are better at producing improvements in test scores, there are other schools that are better at producing social emotional well-being or hard work ability. And interestingly, it's not that correlated. Right.
The success in both areas is not.
Yeah.
Related.
These three, you know, there's hard work. We can break the social into, you know, and there's just, you know, there's some that obviously that they're super school. They've got the recipe in all of the dimensions. But for, you know, for the most part, it's not like if you're good at producing test scores, you're also good at producing social emotional development.
Right.
You know, so that suggests potentially that there's actually trade offs here. Right.
Yeah. Like you can invest in one that, at the cost of another, perhaps.
That, you know, with at the resources that are available in these schools, the level of resources that are available, people are facing trade-offs, or we haven't developed the technology. We haven't got the recipe right and published it that everybody has. Oh, yes, we have all this, you know, and that's part of what people who do education research, they're going to have to start figuring out because, I mean, these papers that are looking at the value added of schools in terms of social emotional, I mean, these are 2-3 years old.
Sure.
Right. And the new one, the one that's just out as of a few weeks ago, is the new Roz Chetty Opportunity Insights paper on social capital. There's enormous variation in income mobility across neighborhood.
Yes.
We look across cities, there's enormous variation. But even if you go inside of cities and just move neighborhood to neighborhood, there's as much variation in terms of how much people move up the income ladder. And so the question has always been, so
there's as much variation within cities
within a
as
big
there
city
is
as across
the country.
Yeah. So, you know, you can go, the one that Roz Chetty talks about is just inside of New York City, Queens is a highly mobile place, the Bronx is not. And the question is, well, what drives these geographic variation in mobility? And the new study that they just came out with, you know, the thing that they find that predicts income mobility more than anything else is heterogeneity in your social network. The simple story, the one that it's easy to understand, particularly if you went to a large public high school like I did, because there was only one big school in my town, so everybody was there. You saw the whole mix, right? But what that meant was there's an opportunity for somebody from a low income background to interact with more people from a high income background, and particularly if there's not a friendship bias or friending bias is what they call it. Right, where you just stick with your own types of people. If you actually are exposed to them in ways that allow you to become friends with people from, quote, the other side of the tracks, right? Well, then just that exposure appears to matter, right? You know, just that exposure that being friends with people of different backgrounds, it allows you to then learn the secrets, right? Of, oh, I could do that.
We'll be back to our conversation with Bryce Ward after this short break. A New Angle is supported by First Security Bank, Blackfoot Communications, and UM's College of Business. Access to capital, broadband, and education are three ingredients any community needs for success.
Hey, this is Jeff Petticord, and you're listening to A New Angle.
Welcome back to A New Angle. I'm speaking with Bryce Ward about our public education system.
I did research on this, it's almost 15 years ago, right? It wasn't exactly about this, but there was this program that was in Oregon and I was hired to help evaluate it. And it was this really simple program that I was like, this can't possibly work, right? It was just they got some volunteers, right? Retired teachers, other adults in the community. They just came and hung out in like the counseling office.
Okay.
And helped kids fill out their FAFSAs and their college applications.
Wow.
And I did this and I was like, the effects were enormous. We matched all these kids who were in the program or in schools that had the program to whether or not they went to college and where they went to college. And I was like, this is the easiest low-hanging fruit in the world.
Yeah.
And it turns out that this has now been replicated in a number of other studies, right? But it's that exact thing, which I think is what's happening with the friending stuff.
Sure.
Is I just become friends and I start hanging out at so-and-so's house. And so-and-so's house, their parents are college educated, and yep. That's just in the air at that house. And now they're like, you know, we're at dinner, whatever it is, and they ask, oh, hey, are you going to go to college? And you're like, I don't know. Well, this is fine. Like, we
you
can do this.
You just open up that door.
You just open it up. It exposes you, and that exposure appears to matter.
Does it flow both ways? As you're describing it crudely, the poor kids get a lot out of hanging out with the rich kids. Does it flow the other way? Do the rich kids benefit from hanging out with the poor kids?
Well, in their study, they were just focused on income mobility.
Sure.
So, you
trying
know,
to increase
like,
income
yeah,
mobility.
So that, you know, that they're just trying to understand why some places the poor kids, when they're older, are richer
yep.
than other poor kids.
Okay.
Right?
So we're measuring a narrow
you know,
set
but,
of outcomes.
But when we look at other studies about the similar kind of stuff, yes. The classic studies are roommate studies, mm-hmm. right? So you go to college, you randomly get signed a roommate. You know, when you say, okay, well, I got assigned a roommate that was very different than me. And the easiest, of course, is just race.
Yep.
You know, studies that have looked at random roommate assignment, and it's been a while since I've looked at these, but if I recall correctly, they move the needle in terms of sympathy towards the other types of people
sure.
that you happen to be exposed to. And those effects persist even after you're no longer roommates.
Yeah. I mean, classic, like, contact hypothesis from the 50s. So, okay. So, I mean, this is the generalizable statement is diversity in your friend group really matters and is really important.
That would appear to be the, you know, particularly from an income mobility perspective, if you're trying to understand why some places do a really good job of moving the needle in terms of why people climb the income ladder, that diversity in the friendship network matters. And the cool thing is this study, if you go to socialcapital.org,
uh-huh.
like they have a map. They have like literally every school.
The map, the data set and the visualization.
You can look up your
amazing.
High school. You can look up your college in terms of both, you know, in terms of what they call exposure, like how much are we mixing people, but then also the friending bias, right? Are you actually becoming friends with people that have different backgrounds in these places or what are the odds? And, you know, then you've got all sorts of measures that you can compare mm-hmm. and look and see like, you know, which school in your area is doing the best job at actually mixing people or not. And then you could map that into the other maps that they have in terms of, you know, which neighborhoods are actually, you know, and again, you know, the income mobility stuff, it takes time.
Yeah.
Right. So we don't, what we're basically saying is we know that kids who were born in the early 80s, right? Because they're now old enough that we can see what their adult
see what their
earnings,
mobility is.
You know, because usually you kind of plateau in your mid 30s, right? So we really got to wait till you're in your mid 30s. You know, so we're measuring all this stuff, but then we're, you know, the friendship network stuff is more contemporaneous. So we'll see if it actually correlates long term. Because we don't know exactly, because this is new, right? Mm-hmm. Our ability to measure mobility at this granular level, at this geographic scale, is very new.
Yeah.
So we don't know how much it changes over time or, you know, and that'll be the next set of things that we'll learn in the next decade is, oh, well, the kids that were born in this decade, you know, it changed. And we'll be able to say, oh, well, what changed at that time so that
right.
we can then figure out why did this measure of mobility change? But
do we know much about what are the most significant drivers of success at the public school level, or is it curriculum? Is it teacher effects? I know the teacher effects can be tremendously strong.
So if you look at the research on charter schools, and in particular these no excuses charter schools, these are these very disciplined, you know, longer school year, very intense.
Program and curriculum.
You know, and the beauty of these particular programs is oftentimes they're oversubscribed, so there's lotteries to get in. So we get to use a lottery mechanism to evaluate them. And the research that I've seen suggests that the no excuses charter schools, you know, which is kind of a whole measurement. We can't separate it because there's a whole, so many different components. But no excuses charter schools, which are mostly predominant in low income urban areas.
Yep.
But in that environment, they appear to be very, very successful.
Okay.
Now, other charter schools, now I don't know if they're no excuses charter schools or not, but, you know, so the best research on this comes out of Boston. Nobel Prize winner Josh Angrist and his team have looked at this, right? They basically find that the no excuses charter schools do a great job, but you go out in the suburbs and the charter schools there basically take middle class, upper middle class kids and do nothing to them. So it's not that charter schools
do nothing to them that's different than the normal
they may
school.
Actually make them slightly worse off.
Oh, interesting.
You know, it may be no effect, but there's a couple of different studies. Sure. One study shows, you know, very increasing school choice actually made them worse off. And a different study shows that there's kind of nothing or maybe a slight decline to the extent that, you know, for at least again, and this is again, going back to that magic recipe, right?
Yeah.
That for each individual student or type of student, we've got to figure out how to match. But the no excuses charter school model, which includes a whole bunch of, we can't break it apart because we haven't broken that apart. But if you put all of it together, it appears to be very effective.
Yeah. So in our remaining time, Bryce, I would like to just ask you, how much do we know about the effects of some of the schools' closures that we lived through during COVID? I know it's too early to tell on some of the longer-term outcome measures, but what do we know already?
It was bad. In general, if you think about the recipe for student success, it's not just about schools, right? That recipe also includes the rest of the environment that the kid is operating in. So from home environment to neighborhood to community and all that kind of stuff. And so in places where the set of resources that are otherwise surrounding the child tend to be more depressed, they're poorer, or, you know, just the resources available are less, you know, there's just not as much available to them. School is a bigger deal, right? We really hinge, their success really does depend on school,
right?
Because there's not some substitute, right? You know, for affluent families, if the school isn't there, the family will step in with other resources.
They have more resources to replicate the effects.
There's more resources available to replicate the effects. And so in households or for kids for whom school's really the main lever.
Yeah.
Things, for those kids, school closures seem to have the worst effects.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the bigger question that we'll start learning the answer to probably, I'm assuming, in a few weeks. So we've looked at test scores from the 2019-2020 school year, which is when the initial shutdowns were. We've looked at stuff from the 2020-2021 school year, which is when there was huge variation, right? So some places just went back and dealt with COVID. Some places were hybrid. Some places were still remote. There was a lot of variation.
Yeah.
And then the 2022 or 2021-2022 school year, which, you know, was the last school year, we should start getting their, you know, this test that we tend to use to look at this stuff. And most people were back. And so the big question is, okay, how well were we able to start catching people back up? And, you know, if we go back to those surveys that we started with, the parent survey, well, one of those parent surveys, they actually did it first in 2021 and they did it again in 2022. And the share of parents who said that their kid was behind or had been adversely affected by COVID, it fell by roughly half.
Okay.
Right. So at least from a parent perspective, now the parents may not be the best evaluators of their children's achievement.
Although the same parent saying my child was behind, saying that he or she is less behind, that's more reliable.
Yeah. It suggests that something's going on.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll see. We'll see what the, you know, I mean, it's going to be, I mean, we're talking, it's literally a multi-trillion dollar question, right? Because these happen globally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to the extent that we took a big bite out of a whole generation's human capital, we kind of skipped that in the beginning, right? Like the returns to education are one of the most well-established returns in economics, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, if you look globally, right, you know, I mean, most recent study that I could find was some World Bank researchers who took 1,100 different studies on the returns to schooling from across the globe.
Wow.
Just in the past decade, right? I mean, we've been studying this for 60 years, but we've been, you know, we've been changing techniques, right? You know, yes, there's variation. There's variation across people and time and all sorts of stuff. But if you average it out, and this is one of, you know, before the study had even come out, if you had asked me what the average was, I would have said it's 8 to 10%. And what did they find? 9%. So each year of schooling, if just from in terms of your wages, you know, adds 10% to your wages. And that effect has been there forever. You know, it fluctuates. It changes over time. These are economic parameters, but schooling works. And if we've messed that up, right, if we've messed it up in ways that, if COVID has messed it up in ways that depress the number of years of schooling across, you know, multiple years of, you know, 10%, if you take just 1 year for every, you know, I mean, that's a huge hit to the aggregate productive capacity of a generation that we'll all feel, you know. And again, that's just the wage return, right? We don't even add in the fact that there's health returns, there's benefits to your kids, there's benefits to your health, there's benefits even to your parents' health. There's all sorts of other benefits from education that we may have messed up. And so we really do need to be paying very close attention, because we're going to need to mitigate whatever losses, because yeah, it can get to a really big number if we've adversely affected the educational attainment of a number of cohorts.
Yeah, for me, the key takeaway is we've got a system that is largely working pretty darn well. People are generally happy with it. It's providing some important outcomes, and let's not screw it up. And we can screw it up in a wide variety of ways. We don't need to get into all of that. But I will say, Bryce, as we've closed, I will thank you, as always, for this great information. But I think we should also express a little bit of gratitude for all the great folks in our community and beyond who work in this space. Teachers, administrators, parent volunteers, all the support structure. I mean, it's a hard job, and they're doing it overall really well. So thank you.
Ditto. I mean, we really do need to take some time to, you know, continue to express gratitude for the people who keep that particular machine running, because it is one of the most important machines in all of society.
Well said. And we'll see you next month, Bryce. Thanks. Thanks for listening to A New Angle. We really appreciate it. And we're coming to you from Studio 49, a generous gift from UM alums Michelle and Lauren Hansen. A New Angle is presented by First Security Bank, Blackfoot Communications, and the University of Montana College of Business. With additional support from Consolidated Electrical Distributors, Drum Coffee, and Montana Public Radio. Keely Larson is our producer. VTO, Jeff Ament, and John Wicks made our music. Editing by Nick Mott. Social media by AJ Williams. And Jeff Neese is our master of all things sound. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.